House Committee on Judiciary Criminal Law, Thursday, May 20th, 1999, 8:30 a.m., Hearing Room 357.
Good morning. Welcome to the House Judiciary Committee on Criminal Law. We are now in session. We have several bills up this morning, some of which we began to work yesterday. I'll go through these in sequence. Our counsel is out conducting some meetings, so I'll just take care of some of this myself. I'll ask for the sign-up sheet, Rachel, on Senate Bill 320, and we'll convene a public hearing on Senate Bill 320 and find out who's signed up to be here for it. Thank you. Jeff Brown and Fran, is it Kushiko? Kushiko. Good morning. Please come forward. Welcome to the committee. You're the only two witnesses signed up for this bill, and you're both in favor of it, apparently. So please introduce yourselves to the record and tell us why this is a good bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Brown. I'm the deputy legal counsel for the governor.
I am Fran Lushenko, extradition officer for the state of Oregon.
Go ahead. Give you a little background on Senate Bill 320. Basically, it would amend a section of Oregon's version of the Uniform Criminal Extraditions Act in order to specify that where a fugitive is being held in a county jail in Oregon, authorities from the demanding state have 45 days in which to come and take custody of the fugitive. A court may extend that period upon a showing of good cause. This bill is necessary because Oregon's version of the Uniform Criminal Extraditions Act at this time specifies no set length of time for which an Oregon court must hold or supervise a fugitive pursuant to a complaint filed by an Oregon district attorney. There's no uniform standard. Judges have different time limits. Some judges have 30 days. Other judges set it at 2 weeks. There's even been some examples where it's only a matter of days. And in addition to not having a uniform standard, none of those time periods is sufficient to allow the authorities, the governors from other states, to get the documents together they need to come and process the people and get them back to the states where they're fugitives from. This is beginning to have an effect on Oregon's ability to get fugitives back from other states because extradition is really governed by notions of interstate comity, and since it's becoming tougher for people to come here and get fugitives from Oregon based on the lack of a uniform time limit, it's also beginning to be too tough for Oregon to go and get people. So the bill would set a uniform standard again of 45 days, which can be extended upon good cause. We'd be happy to answer any questions. Did you want to add anything?
Well, Mr. Chair, no. Basically, what Jeff has reiterated is kind of a compilation of our thoughts on this, and we would just like to have you consider this.
And I see you did amend it in the Senate to take care of some concerns over there.
Correct. The bill was originally called for a 90-day period. That was thought to be a little bit too long by the defense attorneys, the sheriffs, and the judges, so we amended the bill to 45 days.
Are they comfortable with that?
They have decided that they will not oppose the bill in 45 days.
Representative Brzezinski?
Mr. Chair, if I can just share with the committee, I understand the frustration. When I was in Lane County DA's office, there weren't situations where you actually did not get the paperwork done up here to get signed off and then get the notification for the receiving state to be able to make their arrangements to come out to Oregon and then to the county to pick up. And so you end up going back to the judge and having these extensions, and it seems like this would be appropriate. I guess I do have one question for Jeff as to, is there anything happening on the federal level to maybe try to have something uniformed as to having something that where everyone would be on the same time frame and it would be pretty well standard nationwide
attraction to this world?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brzezinski, I'm not sure if there is a uniform standard in the federal legislation which was enacted to implement the extraditions clause of the U.S. Constitution. Each state then has its uniform act as well, and I think that's where the time limits come in. Fran might be able to shed some additional light.
Mr. Chair and Representative Brzezinski, currently I'm the president of the National Association of Extradition Officials, and one of their main functions is to try to unify and uniform different timelines and forms. And we do have a resolution which apparently hasn't carried much weight with some of the states, but the recommendation is for 90 days. And given the fact that we've tried to compromise and take into consideration different aspects of different people's, like judges and defense attorneys and sheriffs, their different input into this, we did try to compromise. And I think 45 days is going to be ample with the extensions that will be allowed or can be considered.
Thank you. All right. We'll go into work session on Senate Bill 320. Representative Brzezinski?
Chair, I'll move the bill as it's been presented to us with no amendments at this time to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Is there discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the motion is carried. Senate Bill 320 is sent to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Brzezinski, would you like to be the carrier?
Sure.
All right, Representative Brzezinski will carry the bill. And that concludes the work session on Senate Bill 320. We can do business fast around here sometime. Next up is Senate Bill 844. We'll convene the... And by the way, Senator Courtney, are you here on 844? We'll convene the public hearing on Senate Bill 844 and invite Senator Courtney to come forward.
His Majesty.
Did you say that no one else is interested in this bill?
For the record, on the internet, Senator Courtney has his Snoopy tie on this morning.
Yes, it's my bill. We corrected a Georgia statute and everything else to do this.
Well, Senator Courtney, you didn't give us a very broad relating clause. There's no room to maneuver. Representative Zanti, did you have something?
I'd like to hear the opening. I do have a couple of questions. It's just my glance at the bill. I think I'd like to hear.
Well, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Peter Courtney. I'm a state senator from District 17, which is Salem-Keizer. The most powerful statement I could make, and I wish you could be here, is by the principal of North Salem High School. You can see is a letter which is attached, dated May 19, 1999. He came to me and said to me months ago that on many occasions, sex offenders would come into the hallways of North Salem High School or gang members. He would immediately trespass them, which he can do under the law. They then would go outside and stand right in the front door area there. Now, if you don't know North Salem High School, you can just imagine there's most high schools right in front of their door. There's a little cove area or right there in the sidewalks. And they would proceed then to prey on the students because North has an open campus or other, I don't know about your different high schools, but there's such a thing as a closed campus and an open campus. And I would imagine most high schools are open, but whatever. He asked me, he said he heard Georgia had a bill that created a school safety zone area. So I went and got the Georgia statute. And I thought, well, this is rock and roll time. I got here the whole Georgia statute, and I said, I'll just introduce the Georgia statute. But because we have a very good legislative council office, and I believe we do, they wrote me a letter on November 3rd, 1998, outlining to me why they thought, sorry, Georgia Peach, Georgia statute is unconstitutional. But they said there's a way still that we can do something, a little something, to really make a statement about trying to help these schools, to the extent that you can help them, do this job. And so we passed Senate Bill 844A. Basically what it says is that you trespass them, and you tell them, they go outside. Now, and the zone is 1,000 feet. If they're messing around in that zone in some disruptive manner, in other words, they are causing disorderly conduct, inconvenience, annoyance, or alarm, and a law enforcement official or a school employee goes up to them and warns them, you're in 1,000 feet of our school, you can't do that, and they condemn you to do that, you then can cite them for as much as a Class A misdemeanor under the disorderly conduct statute of state of Oregon, as opposed to Class B, which is a stronger form of an existing law, which is disorderly conduct. It's a stronger form of it.
Can I interrupt you for a moment, Senator? I think it's important to make this clarification so we can understand this. What you're doing is you're taking the existing crime of disorderly conduct, which is a Class B misdemeanor.
That's correct.
And you are elevating the crime, so you have all the elements of the current crime still there.
Correct.
And then you're moving it up to Class A if they've done the disorderly conduct plus these other factors.
And they're within 1,000 feet of a public or private elementary or secondary school. So the reason the Georgia statute has a problem, and I'm not going to read it to you, you don't have to give any notice. As soon as they're within that 1,000 feet, they can be cited. And we felt under the Oregon Constitution and under the U.S. Constitution, you cannot do that. You've got to put them on some kind of notice. You're within 1,000 feet of school, and your conduct is causing disruption, annoyance, alarm. And, of course, that's a judgment call of public inconvenience.
Now, that's beyond still the requirement that you're committing a standard disorderly conduct, and it's resulting in this disruption, alarm, and inconvenience.
That's correct, and you're within 1,000 feet of school. We have used 1,000 feet of school before.
Drugs
and things. That's not something that we haven't just thought up. We've used it. Now, I realize that they still could go outside 1,000 feet, and you're going to tape measure and things, but we've already used 1,000 feet of thing. And the fact is, the letter speaks for itself. It's just an added little tool. I don't think North Salem High School is alone. I think, because I've heard from a number of principals across the state, they struggle with gang members. The sex offender thing I was really astounded by, but that apparently there's been a number of instances in schools involving that, too. That's all this bill does. It's the Oregon version of a school safety zone, and I think, as I say, the Georgia statute, if somebody one day takes that up, that Georgia statute, at least if it gets to the United States Supreme Court, could readily be thrown out. I don't mean to knock Georgia, but it's not real tightly drawn. So that's the bill. That's the reason for the bill. That's it.
Thank you, Senator. I've got Representative Bowman and then Representative Prezant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Senator Courtney. This bill does not exempt students who are in the school from being charged with this crime. And so if students are messing around on the school ground, they could also be charged with this particular crime.
Well, that's correct. If they were causing the kinds of nuisances on, if they were causing serious fights and causing, if they were a gang member, for example, in the school and came out and were doing certain things, I assume, yeah, it would apply. That's correct.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair. Is there a standard definition of gang member that would be used statewide in implementing this particular law?
Well, I don't know if there's a standard definition. I think that gang paraphernalia and gang membership is known to school officials and law officers. I'm sure you know that. I don't know if we have a definition. We got into the dress code issue over at Senator Lynn's bill, which is coming over here. And
well, there's nothing in the bill about gangs. I mean,
I'm just trying to give you some examples. And the reason I brought up gangs, Senator Bowman, is Salem, unlike even beats your community when it comes to gang activity and drive-by shootings by gang members. Now, you can say, well, how do you know they're gang members? Well, I'd have to get the law enforcement officials of Salem in here to describe to you why they know for sure they're gang members. And if you got them in here, they would admit to you they were gang members. But the answer to the question is, no, I don't know if it's a definition of gang members. I think sex offender, we know a sex offender because of their criminal background. We could do a criminal background check and find out if they had that kind of record. And I suppose with some of these people, Representative Bowman, if they did a criminal background check, they would find that they had been involved with gang activities of some kind or other. So, I mean, it's known to these principals, pretty much many of who these kids are, where they hang out, and what kind of problems they cause. So you do have a familiarity here. It isn't just stranger to stranger. I must be very frank with you. But, you know, I don't think there is probably, with all due respect to your question, I don't want to dodge it. I don't know in law, Chair Mannix, where there is a specific definition. This is what a gang member is.
Not in that context. We do have some other descriptions about engaging in concerted criminal behavior.
One last question, Mr. Chair. Senator Courtney, I guess my concern with this bill is that if you look at the definition of disorderly conduct, under A on line 7, it says engages in fight or in violent, tremulous, or threatening behavior. You know, if I push Representative Sinceri, that could be perceived as of me being involved in that behavior. So I think we're going down this real slim slope, and that's my concern.
Well, Mr. Chair, the definition of disorderly conduct is already in law, with all due respect. I didn't add anything to that. We didn't try to get carried away. We tried to draw this up in a very limited fashion so it could survive a constitutional challenge. So I don't, you know, if you're uncomfortable with that language, I don't know what to say. That is the disorderly conduct statute that exists in the state of Oregon today. And I have to tell you, there is no way to write a bill, and I've started to say this more and more and more in my eighth term, to address every single situation. You're relying on a police officer or a principal or an assistant principal or a coach to make a judgment call at times, and sometimes they'll blow it, but I have a feeling that they would be, given how we know that suits get filed every second against teachers and administrators, that they would be reluctant to get involved unless they thought they had an explosive situation in their hands. And I know this principal from North Salem High School, and this letter that he wrote is not an exaggerated letter. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it or not. And I don't think North Salem is the exception to the high schools in the state of Oregon, if I may say so. I mean, I don't believe that.
Representative Krasinski is next, and Representative Hansen.
Peter, I understand. I think I understand what they're trying to do. I need a little clarification. North Salem, the configuration of the school, the building to the street, are they like right on top of each other? I ask this in the sense that if you trespass somebody off the property, that doesn't mean just out of the building. That means off the school property.
You're good at drawing verbal pictures anyway, Senator.
North Salem High School is the oldest high school in the state. It's just down here. You went down here.
Okay. It's going on 15th.
It's just down D, and it's the oldest one there. It is an old building square.
Right.
Lot sidewalks around it.
With the yard in front.
I mean, that's correct. South Salem has a little yard in front. It's right over here.
Right.
Sprague is a very modern school. Its 1,000-foot configuration would be a whole different scenario. McNary, more modern. McKay, though, has a front yard, et cetera, et cetera. So, but North is
okay. I'm familiar with it now to know which one you're talking about. I guess in your testimony as to what the principal said, they had difficulty when the person was inside the school, they trespassed them to get them out.
Right.
Is it your understanding that they didn't leave the school property?
Right.
In other words, they just went outside the building?
Right.
Then I guess my first question is, why weren't they arrested for criminal trespass?
It's a public sidewalk.
If I may, from reading...
That's a public sidewalk. They're not... That is a public... The walkway up to the high school...
Stop, please, for a minute. From reading the principal's letter, I think there is a misunderstanding of the testimony. When I read the letter, I understood there is a walkway from the entrance. You go about 50 to 75 feet. Then there is a public sidewalk. And so your ingress and egress still is past that public sidewalk. And from the principal's letter, that public sidewalk is where they're congregating. Senator, you did mention the alcove, but that would, from Representative Fazansky's point of view and mine too, still be on the school property if that's the covered area near the entrance, just visualizing North Salem High School. Go ahead, Senator.
Well, all I'm going to say about that is, here we go, lawyer to lawyer. You know, we get this bill up before our Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court, and what I'm saying is I'd rather have this kind of law that at least affords the protection. I think you could bring in ACLU types or Ingrid Swenson behind me and say, in their opinion, the public sidewalk begins here versus here. And these principals don't want to have to deal with that kind of mind-playing game. They want to know at least they got 1,000 feet, and I realize what's 1,000 feet, where if they're out there getting in fist fights or confronting people, or this sex offender sitting out there waiting for girls to come out, they can say, you know, even there, though, there's got to be some contact. You move back off, you got to move back a certain distance, or we're calling the police, and they can come in there and cite you. So, I mean, I don't know where the public, how you want to talk about when public and when school property begins.
Let me ask you a couple other questions if I can. Under disorderly conduct, as it's currently written, right, which is not going to change except for changing one word, which I think is appropriate, creates versus created, hazardous physical offensive condition. B is makes unreasonable noise.
Right.
If you have students at that school who want to protest some action or whatever, and they are out there exercising what I would consider their free speech rights, are they not going to be subject to these type of charges while they're doing that?
But they got a boombox out there going to the point that classes cannot be conducted in the school. You can't classes.
I guess that's not my concern as to what's going on with the boombox.
Well, but you said, I'm trying to be able to phrase unreasonable noise as opposed to freedom of speech. And when does unreasonable noise take precedence over freedom of speech? And what I'm saying is, I don't think, you know, if they're just having speeches and things, Floyd, I don't think that's unreasonable noise, to be very frank with you. But I think a boombox, you know what I'm talking about, the boombox and that kind of thing. I think that would get into a situation where we got an unreasonable noise versus freedom of speech issue. But, you know, it's interesting, Representative Bowman's question. This is not designed at students who just go outside the building that are basically students, you know, frolicking and things. We're dealing with very serious people that are very real, that are real examples, that have really happened in real schools.
Senator, I need to ask this question. Do you want this bill to address students who are registered at that school or not? Because right now the bill is so written as to include students who are registered at the school. I would add that I discerned, maybe incorrectly, that the reason for that was by moving it up to a Class A misdemeanor, a juvenile can be detained for a Class A misdemeanor. Usually police cannot take a juvenile into custody, as I understand it, for a B or C misdemeanor. So I thought perhaps through the back door, so to speak, you were enhancing the power of the authorities to step in and detain somebody for engaging in this behavior who might also be a student. If that wasn't your intent, perhaps we should amend the bill to exclude students who are registered at the school from the coverage, so you're truly dealing with outsiders.
But the problem is, you could have a student who's sort of marginal. They're missing some school. They are a gang member. They have been a troublemaker. They may have brought deadly force. They could be trying to decide whether to expel them or not. And they're outside. And because we say they have some connection with the school in terms of whether or not they're a student, it doesn't matter that they're told move back 1,000 feet. So I'm not sure, you know, Representative Maddox, that that's smart to do. I can see some students being a problem for a school even though they're a member of the school. They decide to go outside and hang with their gang members even though they're just getting from outside. And they're in there problem with these gang members who are not students.
Then I would say, Senator, then the language here is fine as long as we understand that unreasonable noise within the hallway, which would be somewhat defined later to the judicial system, is included in the bill as part of disorderly conduct, but there would have to be a confrontation with the individual. The person would have to be warned that their conduct was out of line. Then if they continued the conduct, they could be charged with a Class A misdemeanor. Now, the chair, I'm very sympathetic to this, but I think that there's some committee members from both sides of the aisle that have some concerns here that you will need to work on to warm them up to this approach. My own view is that the schools ought to have more authority and to deal with persons on campus and right off campus, and I don't have a problem with using it, but other people do, and it's always necessary to get a constitutional majority to move something.
Sure.
Representative Hansen's been waiting.
I've been patiently waiting.
The
problem I've got with this is, if basically all we're doing is elevating the disorderly conduct up from a B to an A if it occurs within 1,000 feet, all of the situations that you've pointed out would have been prosecutable or people could have made arrests at the B level. So I guess what I need to convince you that this is what we need to do is that if somehow the Southern Police had been citing people for the B misdemeanor and that hasn't proved to be a deterrent, then I would think elevating it to an A would be the logical next step. But if they're not enforcing the disorderly conduct law that's on the books at the level that it's at now, then I don't know. I think it's a problem of them not enforcing it, or it's a violation that doesn't relate to the types of conduct that you want to address, i.e. getting the people that have been trespassing that are still hanging around close. What I don't know is really how is this going to change anything? If they're not enforcing the B misdemeanor, or if that doesn't quite fit the type of conduct that you want to change.
The fact that you have to move them back, that there's a zone, they have to go back beyond the zone, or it's a Class A, is a significant statement. I wish I could have brought you a letter that was faxed to me yesterday by a teacher who taught my wife for 10 years at Whitaker Junior High School. She's been there 31 years. And I read it last night. What she says is going on in school today at Whitaker right up here, which is a middle school. It's just the most frightening thing I've read in the long terms in terms of what we now, our poor teachers, are having to deal with. And what I'm saying here is, first of all, you do two things here. You warn somebody. You got to warn them. Your conduct is offensive, and you're within 1,000 feet of this school. We're just warning you, that's a Class A misdemeanor versus a Class B. So this is a double hit. You're making a public policy statement about the sanctity of schools and violence and troublemakers in and around our school districts at a time when it is very serious, or this principal wouldn't have come to me and written me this kind of letter. And so the police department can come out there now, and, you know, some of this is deterrence. Some of this is deterrence. You know, I mean, the idea that, well, we just get the law enforcement officials. The word will get out. They got this zone out there. There is this definite zone. You don't want to violate it. By moving them back, it does allow students who do go out to slow out in the front yards and buildings and things like that for different reasons to at least know that this kind of conduct hopefully will be moved back far enough that these individuals won't hang around because they can't make contact with the students. They can't carry on. They can't get into these fights. These sex offenders have got to move back because it's a heavier fine. It's a jail sentence, and a fine is greater.
Well, is anybody enforcing the deed now?
Well, I think they're enforcing it. I don't have the Salem Police here. They're enforcing it, but I think that the problem we're having is that apparently we're not getting into enough of an enforcement that they don't feel, that these people feel they want a bigger hammer. They want a bigger hammer. In Georgia, the hammer was even bigger than this. You're in that 1,000 feet, you're a goner. You are a goner. No questions asked. Not Georgia. So it's just a way of saying we don't want you near our schools, within 1,000 feet of our schools.
President Hanson, further question? Well, it's maybe irrelevant, but on the way down this morning, I heard there was another school shooting.
Right, Georgia.
Georgia was six more kids hit. So
right.
Problem's not going away. Representative Krasinski, you had some further question or comment?
I'm looking at this. I look at E, where it says conjugate with other persons in a public place or refuses to comply with the lawful order of the police to disperse. And in 1,000 feet of the school, from the schools that I've heard described and from what I know, that's going to take in residential areas. And I've got a real problem with that, Peter. I mean, I've got students down at University of Oregon, and they're protesting something they think is not wrong. Yes, this would not apply to this campus because it's not a secondary or a primary school. But I can see, and we've had kids that were protesting violence up in the north of here, I forget exactly what community it was, that are going to potentially get caught up in this. And I don't think that's really the way I want to have this type of means, just because we've now created this zone that seems to me to be very broad and beyond. I mean, the issue that it seems to me that there's got to be a better way to focus on the issue that you brought to us than doing it through this method. And I can't think of what it is right now.
I see what you mean. Now, Senator Courtney, I'm picking up signals from both sides here. We mix and mingle here anyway, but I'm picking up signals from all sides about, and that means Republican and Democrat and conservative and liberal, about some concerns here. The one thought that comes to my mind is it seems like the underlying issue is lack of prosecution, because if you had people arrested for the Class B misdemeanor, taken to the county jail, booked, I would think that the sexual predator or whomever who was hanging around, after a couple of those events, they might even decide that person is dangerous enough to keep them in jail for a few days pending a review of the situation. But the thought that comes to mind is, as we're dealing with school funding, maybe we should include in the school funding
some provision for dedicated funding for prosecutors to prosecute individuals relating to offenses on school property or adjoining school property. I'm just throwing this out off the top of my head. If that's the problem and there's not enough backup, so when this conduct is occurring and prosecutors don't think they have the resources to prioritize it, we could say, well, some sliver of money will go towards prioritizing this kind of prosecution. I remain sympathetic to the bill, Senator, but I think you need to work on some of the committee members if we're going to change.
No, I think what I need to do is bring the principal North in here, because... You're in that 1,000 feet, you're a goner. You are a goner. No questions asked. Not Georgia. So it's just a way of saying we don't want you near our schools, within 1,000 feet of our schools.
President Hanson, further question?
Well, it's maybe irrelevant, but on the way down this morning, I heard there was another school shooting.
Right, Georgia.
Six more kids hit. So
right.
Problem's not going away. Representative Przanski, you had some further question or comment?
I'm looking at this. I look at E, where it says congregate with other persons in a public place or refuses to comply with the lawful order of the police to disperse. And in 1,000 feet of the school, from the schools that I've heard described and from what I know, that's going to take in residential areas. And I've got a real problem with that, Peter. I mean, I've got students down at University of Oregon, and they're protesting something they think is not wrong. Yes, this would not apply to this campus because it's not a secondary or a primary school. But I can see, and we've had kids that were protesting violence up in the north of here. I forget exactly what community it was. That are going to potentially get caught up in this. And I don't think that's really the way I want to have this type of means, just because we've now created this zone that seems to me to be very broad and beyond. I mean, the issue that it seems to me that there's got to be a better way to focus on the issue that you brought to us than doing it through this method. And I can't think of what it is right now.
I see what you mean. Now, Senator Courtney, I'm picking up signals from both sides here. We mix and mingle here anyway, but I'm picking up signals from all sides about, and that means Republican and Democrat and conservative and liberal, about some concerns here. The one thought that comes to my mind is it seems like the underlying issue is lack of prosecution, because if you had people arrested for the Class B misdemeanor, taken to the county jail, booked, I would think that the sexual predator or whomever who was hanging around, after a couple of those events, they might even decide that person is dangerous enough to keep them in jail for a few days pending a review of the situation. But the thought that comes to mind is, as we're dealing with school funding, maybe we should include in the school funding some provision for dedicated funding for prosecutors to prosecute individuals relating to offenses on school property or adjoining school property. I'm just throwing this out off the top of my head. If that's a problem and there's not enough backup, so when this conduct is occurring and prosecutors don't think they have the resources to prioritize it, we could say, well, some sliver of money will go towards prioritizing this kind of prosecution. I remain sympathetic to the bill, Senator, but I think you need to work on some of the committee members if we're going to change.
No, I think what I need to do is bring the principal north in here, because, you know, we're speaking very intellectually and academically here. In the everyday life of principals in high schools who have to run these institutions that are terribly crowded, that are loaded with all kinds of violence and discipline problems, and we know it across the state, these individuals are trying to develop a world where you can teach. And if the principal's here, he might be able to talk to you about some of these things in a way that it makes a lot of sense than to simply say, well, we'll simply call the Salem police out there. We have a 1,000-foot rule law now in the state of Oregon. We passed it several sessions ago, whether people like it or not. And it says you better not be caught selling drugs within 1,000 feet of schools. And there's another 1,000-foot bill we passed regarding schools. Don't forget what that one is. We have
Constitution.
We have two 1,000-foot things right now that we put together in this room, because we wanted to make a statement. We will not tolerate certain things within 1,000 feet of school. And the neighborhood's issue argument could be made there as well, Representative Przanski. Drugs and prostitution. And we had a problem in Portland, which was very serious about the prostitution thing. Because, you know, they had a motel room that was close to 1,000 feet, and they were soliciting young girls. I mean, I won't even get into it. So we've battled out the 1,000 feet before in terms of going into a neighborhood or not. The freedom of speech, fine. I'm very sympathetic with that. I just know that we have gang members and sex offenders and troublemakers that are disrupting. And so the 1,000 feet issue should not be an issue. We've already been through that issue. We resolved
the problem. I'm going to interject, and then I'll call on the other members, and I'll give everybody one more shot here. The problem, Senator, is that in those cases, we are dealing with more refined crimes, drug manufacturing, drug dealing, drug possession. And even then, we had to do some refinements. And you can talk about prostitution and soliciting prostitution. They're fairly specifically defined crimes. Disorderly conduct is one of the more general statutes is still on the books, and that's a problem. But let me call on each member, and I'm going to just run right by from right to left and give everybody else one more round here. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Courtney, currently, if someone's released from jail as a sex offender, part of their post-prison supervision is for them to stay away from schools or places where children congregate. So my question to you is, why couldn't they just call the police and say, you know, you need to pick this person up? I mean, that person would go back to jail if they, in fact, were caught inside a school. So I don't see how this bill will help keep sex offenders out of schools.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that's always part of the post-prison supervision restrictions on all sex offenders. I'm not sure of that.
It is.
All right. I'm Representative Sinceri.
That was the question.
Representative Gianella. Representative Przanski.
Peter, this is, I guess, my frustration is I look at what the actual conduct would have to be for disorderly conduct. It's already the law right now. If you have the situations you're talking about, if you've got somebody that's either a sex offender that's not supposed to be around kids, we know that they should already be picked up, even if they don't have that restriction, or if you have somebody that's been identified as a gang member. If they're not violating the disorderly conduct law and they're just hanging there and then walking up and down the sidewalk, you're not going to be able, I mean, this law doesn't apply to that.
I understand that. That's why we had to change it. But that was the Georgia statute, and I understand that. They've got to start, and kids go outside, start to cause a disruption.
What it says here is that notwithstanding subsection 2 of this section, disorderly conduct is a Class A misdemeanor if, A, the person commits the crime of disorderly conduct described in subsection 1. So if you've got somebody that's on the public sidewalk, just walking up and down, not making unreasonable noise, not engaging in fighting activity, not disturbing any lawful assembly or whatever else is prohibited, this law, you're not going to change it. They can still be there.
I understand that. This is not what the principal totally wanted. They have to buy this into this because otherwise it's unconstitutional. But at least if they start to cause trouble, they can come down with a heavier hammer on them in terms of when the kids get out there. That's what they're trying to discourage.
Senator, if I may, couldn't we talk about an exclusionary order? There are constitutional provisions in which somebody having committed one offense already in a certain area can be excluded from that area. And if they're carefully refined exclusions, those have been upheld. Is that something that's been considered?
I don't know.
And where if there's an exclusion order issued by the judge saying you've been convicted of disorderly conduct, I'm now telling you that you are excluded from 1,000 feet of a school. I'm just bringing out a idea. Representative Hansen?
Well, I'd be very willing to work on ways to enhance things within that 1,000 feet. I don't think this gets you where you need to go. But trying to do something to elevate that safety within 1,000 feet of school is good project. But I don't think this meets what needs to be done.
Senator, one other thought you might consider is if we could be precise about some other crimes, for instance, assault. You could come up with a number of crimes where you might focus on those and establish an exclusionary provision. But I am saying right now it looks like we don't have a congealed support group for this bill. And if you would like to bring the principal back, I'd give you that opportunity. For the time being, we'll hang steady.
Okay.
Representative Hansen.
Would there be a way to extend someone that has been trespassed from a school to change that part so that it extended to 1,000 feet from the school?
That would be a legitimate option to say that if you've been convicted of trespass on school property, that is it becomes a higher offense if you come within 1,000 feet of that school if the judge orders that as part of the sentencing. I mean, the judge already has that authority to say stay away.
Right.
But it won't matter.
If they violate that, then they can be back in for a probation violation.
Well, we need to let this gestate a little bit, Senator.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time this morning. Is there anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 844? Seeing no other witnesses, the public hearing is concluded. We will move on to Senate Bill 345. This was up yesterday. I'll move us into public hearing on Senate Bill 345. Diane Middle, good morning.
Good morning, Chair Mannix, members of the committee. My name is Diane Middle. I'm the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and I won't talk quite as fast today. What this bill is about is it basically has two portions, one that was described yesterday, which has to do with some basic housekeeping. As you all know, the department has expanded significantly over about approximately the last 5 to 6 years. We're no longer just the police academy. We now handle corrections, parole and probation, telecommunicators, the 911 dispatchers, private security, fire service, and I hope I haven't missed anybody. But it's a long list. Plus, we do a lot of specialized training for a number of different groups. With that came some problems. Basically, our finances did not increase significantly, nor did our facilities. So in reference to the housekeeping portion, what this allowed us to do is as our bills and our statutes increased in language, it became very confusing as to who was covered by which section of the statutes. What this does now is group people together and then tell us completely who the exclusions are so we know very clearly in tracking who's covered by what sections of the rules and the law. The other part, in many ways, is more significant, and that has to do with dealing with our growth and being able to provide the services we need to as closely as we can to our budget. it allows us to do such things as the experimental projects we've had with Portland Police Bureau and Eugene Police Bureau, which are now pilots but may be worthy of continuation. The jury's not in on that one yet, but we're still looking at whether or not, when we get into backlogs, providing some of the basic training at off-site locations and with agencies such as Portland and Eugene that had some massive hiring, and it allowed us not to delay the training of some of the smaller agencies in order to accommodate the larger agencies. The other thing it does is in areas like correction, we have experimented with providing services where the correctional facilities are being built, such as Treasure Valley Community College, which is next to Snake River. We're about to start another pilot with Blue Mountain Community College for the Umatilla facility.
And the idea there is to allow folks in the local community to have an opportunity to get employment at that facility as it's constructed by giving them a chance to get the necessary education?
Actually, once they are hired, what it means is that they don't have to travel all the way to Monmouth to get that training. They can stay in their communities. We don't have the same housing costs, the transportation costs, and so it significantly reduced the cost to Department of Corrections and the local counties. So
flexible delivery of service.
Very flexible delivery. The way it's designed is to not mandate a certain form, but to allow us to continue to experiment and find out what's the most cost-effective as well as the most efficient in getting the training delivered. The other thing it allows us to do is start to experiment with some of the technology for distance learning so that we can potentially provide maintenance training over time. As you remember, Baker City had some issues a couple of years back, and most of those issues dealt with not getting training after basic. So it opens up a lot of those parameters. It also allows us the ability to assess fees when we start to work with private entities that obviously are in it for a business purpose and are gaining a financial benefit from it, and allows us to oversee that to make sure that in the course of gaining a financial business benefit, we don't lose any quality. So it allows us to do a number of things. This came about from a group effort from all of our constituents. We spent approximately a year canvassing and working with and talking with all of our constituents about what it was they wanted and needed, what their concerns were. And this came about from working with all of them and getting their agreement. As I indicated yesterday, on the Senate side, we did go through a number of amendments. Primarily those had to do with, we had suggested the possibility of doing self-sponsored training at some point in time. I think that was a little premature for some people. It was not something we were going to mandate right now, but they wanted more discussion before we ventured into that, so we removed that section for this go-around. The other areas we talked about was making sure that the state did not give up its oversight in especially the skills areas and the more sensitive areas, and that if training is done at the colleges, that they are limited if they're doing solo training without direct oversight to the academic areas. We will still be able to continue with processes such as we do at Treasure Valley Community College, where we provide the skills on site for them. So what it does is open up our avenues for flexibility, and as I indicate, at this point in time, I don't believe there's any opposition that we have resolved everyone's issues.
And what kind of support did you find on the Senate side?
It was very good. I don't think there were any real concerns once we got
there. Any opposition other than technical adjustments?
No, not other than technical adjustments that we made.
All right. Representative Bowman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Ms. Middleton. I had a question about BPSST charging for the use of their employees when the employees are asked to be an expert witness. Number one, I can't find it anywhere in the bill, and it's in a staff summary. And number two, I'd like you to talk about that. Why the charge, and is the employee getting this money, or does it go back to the department?
Okay. Chairman Exton, Representative Bowman, that was one of the initial amendments that came out. It was an oversight in the first printing, but it is in there now. What that has to do with is, especially in many civil litigations, private counsel would subpoena our staff members, our training instructors, to come and be expert witnesses, and they would do it in such a way that we did not get any compensation for their time, and they were, well, frankly, as much as once a week these subpoenas would be coming in. It was a huge burden on the agency because our very best instructors spent a good portion of their time waiting and testifying in courts at a great expense to the agency. What this does is puts us in a similar place as the forensic experts at the crime lab and those kinds of things, where if they're going to, they're going to have to compensate for their time, pay them for the experts, which is what they're hiring them to do, and gets us covered that way. It goes back into the agency, so we do not have a situation where our instructors are in essence double dipping. What we're hoping this will do is curtail the use significantly of those state employees so that we have the benefit of them being at the institution in training.
The idea that absent this statute, unlike the, say, forensics lab persons, then you get a free shot at subpoenaing a public official to leave their teaching position and come into town somewhere to testify?
Exactly, at hours and days at a time, including long, lengthy depositions, which was taking them, and even the preparation was taking them as much as a week sometimes to review cases that, as an agency, we had no involvement in. We were strictly had been generically as trainers and had a baseline of knowledge about the kinds of skills an officer would be trained with.
So it's sort of a cheap rent and expert system.
That's exactly what it was, or is.
Do we have an emergency clause in this bill?
We do not.
If I could have one follow-up,
sure,
Mr. Chair.
Sure,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Middleton, the next bill has nothing to do with you, but I have a question about, it's not the bill we're working on now, but the next one we're going to deal with deals with the laser pointer. And what I want to know is what kind of training are we providing law enforcement officers around those laser pointers? Because that next bill will make it a crime. But in my opinion, it doesn't change law enforcement's actions unless there's some new training that's taking place.
Chairman, Representative Bowman, currently there isn't any direct training, but let me tell you a little bit about how they do get training in that area. We have part of the training, especially in firearms, has to do with very rapid decision making, and we use what we call the FATS machine, which is the firearms training simulator. What that does is it puts an officer in scenario situations which are very lifelike, and they have to make very rapid decisions as to whether to draw their weapon, what command to give, and whether to fire. And those scenarios are changed by an operator who's actually working the computer, so they never know what they're going to get or how the sequence of events are going to come out. And part of that is training for just those kinds of things, to analyze what you really have and what that situation is. I would suspect that the company that makes that will be coming out with just that type of a scenario, because it is something that's happening around the country, and we do get regular updates on that. And I would have no qualms about suggesting to the company that they include that in their scenarios if it's not already. But it's that kind of training that we do on a regular basis to make sure when they're making that decision to fire or not or to use deadly force that they are really looking at the entire surroundings and what's going on. And that's what that's about, is making those quick decisions.
Thank you.
Other questions? Anything further?
Not for me.
Thank you.
Oh, maybe there is one other further thing. I noticed that I did have the fiscal statement attached to that. This has been incorporated and considered in our budget, knowing that we do have to expand our training. So there is no additional fiscal impact that has not already been considered in our budget.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Is there anybody else to testify on Senate Bill 345? Close the public hearing on bill. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 340. Jeff Brown?
Oh, that's
we did 320.
We did 320.
Yeah.
Sure did. 443?
Yep, 443 and 848.
Okay, do we have a...
Just a work session.
Okay, I think we will stand the committee down for a moment then. We don't have enough people to vote.
Sure, we do. We got a majority. Of course, you'd be outnumbered, but that's fine.
Never.
Are you trying hard to get my attention over here? All right, now.
Yeah. Is there anybody here that's going to testify?
We've got one other bill.
And we've got amendments. Here he is. The hearing on that.
Oh, you have closed
yeah.
The hearing on that. All right. Thank you, Representative Lasseri. I appreciate that. I was out there conferring with Representative Westland. The next bill that we have listed is Senate Bill 443. We'll go into. This is a work session, but we're going to invite testimony. Senate Bill 443. I understand that the Oregon Medical Association has some comments to offer on the amendments, but Scott Gallant is back in hearing room B.
I asked if anybody wanted to speak on this.
Anyone else want to speak on this? Please come forward. Well, we'll call this invited testimony during the work session. Please introduce yourselves for the record.
Good morning. My name is Pat Amadeo. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Community Pharmacy Council, which really includes the majority of chain drugstores in Oregon. We are here to oppose the proposed amendment to 443 that would define intoxicating substance to include something other than a controlled substance. Primarily, our concern is that legal over-the-counter drugs and prescribed drugs, when taken in their prescribed dosages, may fall into this category. For example, antihistamines,
I understand what you're saying. Is the concern of your clients the potential liability, or is it that it's okay for people to be taking that stuff and driving and unable to control the car? That's a tough question.
It's a tough question. It's a tough question when somebody kind of takes these drugs, follows the instructions, and inadvertently has a reaction that causes them to be defined as taking an intoxicating substance.
Well, this is the offense of driving while under the influence itself is always thought of as the offense is being behind the wheel while under the influence, and you're supposed to be reasonable about not allowing yourself to drive. But I am quite serious about the idea as to whether or not we should throw in some liability immunity, immunity from liability, in exchange for having a broader net here, so that if somebody does choose, I mean, I got all the over-the-counter stuff I get, you know, for antihistamines or whatever, warns you about dosages. If I pop a handful of those and I'm all woozy and I get behind the wheel, I'm just as dangerous as if I've had four or five beers, and the person who gets run down is just as dead. So the question would be, and I can understand being sensitive to what civil trial lawyers can do, that you don't want to open the door to the idea that the corner pharmacy can be sued because they sold somebody a box of antihistamine tablets and then they suddenly abused them and went out and were driving while intoxicated. Unlike the dram shop situation where you're selling something to people that's designed to give them a little bit of a lift. It's actually a depressive alcohol, but that's another story. I mean, we've created all this dram shop liability. You're not selling them this stuff to get intoxicated or under the influence or lose control of themselves. You're selling it to deal with some illness or whatever. And again, I'm not pressing for these amendments in particular, but would it be helpful if there was a simple exemption from liability and just say, we're after the driver who's woozy and we don't care about getting after anybody else? Just asking that open-ended question.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Richard Kosas and Jasmine Johnson. I would, with an initial reaction, say no.
Why is that?
Some of your prescription drugs, some of your over-the-counter drugs will be... individual response will be drastically different in terms of an antihistamine is a very good example. To one individual, the body type, body makeup, the individual can become very drowsy. To another individual with some antihistamine, it's a stimulant. There's no middle ground. But
should they be driving under either of those circumstances if they're overstimulated or overdrowsy?
Mr. Chair, if an individual were to ingest a cold pill, a legal product, over-the-counter product, and they experienced drowsiness. They had a problem, a fender bender. Could that be used later on as the question of introducing an intoxicant to the individual? I think that is a very, very, very obscure debate and very difficult to demonstrate.
Well, isn't the question really whether or not somebody should be in control of their faculties while they're in control of a 3,000 or 4,000-pound vehicle?
Mr. Chair, I would wholeheartedly agree.
And then stepping back from that, understanding that we're not dealing with malfactors here, and separate from the dram shop laws, which I have some problems with myself, by the way, because I think they've been abused by some folks who feel like they ought to sue someone else when they've had too much to drink and they should be responsible for their own conduct. But in this area... shouldn't we still be, isn't that something that a judge or a jury or a prosecutor can make a reasonable judgment call about? You've got the package of pills on the seat next to you, and it's one of those, there are all these little sealed packets now, and one little foil tab is broken, and obviously someone had a reaction, so you just say, well, we're not going to press this. And by the way, and you know, that's an overreaction or whatever else, as opposed to the person, and you find that they have a 24-pack of pills, and for all we know, maybe they thought that was a way to commit suicide, and they took them all with a glass of water, and they're just totally out of control. And shouldn't we hold them responsible for that?
Mr. Chair, if an individual is acting irresponsibly, they should act responsibly. That's the clear issue. But if an individual takes no intoxicants and takes no pills, no drugs, and leaves the Capitol at 9:45 in the evening is an extremely tired state, should that individual be operating a motor vehicle?
Depends on whether they had a good day or a bad day.
Mr. Chair, that's probably very, very good.
Well, let me do this. I'd like you to consider the option of saying, look, and it's hard to say that you took the right level of dosage per the package. You know, you could say that, I suppose, if it's demonstrated that the person violated the dosage restrictions on the package and throw in immunity from liability. On the other hand, the proponents of the measure came over here with a fairly limited measure, and it wasn't like it was our bill and we were going to go to town with it. There is a separate issue of inhalants. And what's your position on that? Because we also requested amendments on inhalants, and they're not in front of us yet.
We don't have any concerns with the inhalant language. It is this particular language in which somebody is taking a legal over-the-counter drug and they just take one tablet. 9 times out of 10, the person's condition is such that it doesn't ever affect them. And for some reason, because of, you know, the moon or whatever, what they've eaten that day, they have an unusual effect. We think that's troublesome.
Well, those are legitimate concerns. And what we'll do is hold this over while we see about an inhalants amendment. If there's some word from your clients that with some restriction, and again, maybe our committee doesn't want to go this way anyway because it could affect inadvertent conduct. President Sinceri.
Here's a question. I think when a person drinks alcohol and then gets in a car, they can reasonably expect that they drink too much of it. They're going to have a reaction that they ought to be responsible and avoid that if possible. But what I want to know is, and I think you've said it, but isn't there a situation where a person can take some kind of medication where they are not reasonably expecting this kind of reaction, but it could happen, and it may not happen every time, but it could happen sometimes. So there's certainly no intent there for this kind of thing to happen, and my concern is that this would cover that when maybe it shouldn't cover that.
So and the main point being, with alcohol, the anticipated effect is well known. Mm-hmm. Given whatever dosage is taken, there's some relative effect as opposed to the unanticipated effect of some medication.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. You said it far better than Richard or I.
President Bowman.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the other troubling thing...
Bill tab is broken, and obviously someone had a reaction, so you just say, well, we're not going to press this. And by the way, and you know, that's an overreaction or whatever else, as opposed to the person and you find that they have a 24-pack of pills, and for all we know, maybe they thought that was a way to commit suicide, and they took them all with a glass of water, and they're just totally out of control. And shouldn't we hold them responsible for that?
Mr. Chair, if an individual is acting irresponsibly, they should act responsibly. That's the clear issue. But if an individual takes no intoxicants and takes no pills, no drugs, and leaves the Capitol at 9:45 in the evening in an extremely tired state, should that individual be operating a motor vehicle? I would.
Depends on whether they had a good day or a bad day.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's probably very, very good.
Well, let me do this. I'd like you to consider the option of saying, look, and it's hard to say that you took the right level of dosage per the package. You know, you could say that, I suppose, if it's demonstrated that the person violated the dosage restrictions on the package and throw in immunity from liability. On the other hand, the proponents of the measure came over here with a fairly limited measure, and it wasn't like it was our bill and we were going to go to town with it. There is a separate issue of inhalants, and what's your position on that? Because we also requested amendments on inhalants, and they're not in front of us yet.
We don't have any concerns with the inhalant language. It is this particular language in which somebody is taking a legal over-the-counter drug, and they just take one tablet. 9 times out of 10, the person's condition is such that it doesn't ever affect them, and for some reason, because of the moon or whatever, what they've eaten that day, they have an unusual effect. We think that's troublesome.
Well, those are legitimate concerns, and what we'll do is hold this over while we see about an inhalants amendment. If there's some word from your clients that with some restriction, and again, maybe our committee doesn't want to go this way anyway because it could affect inadvertent conduct. President Sinceri.
Here's a question. I think when a person drinks alcohol and then gets in a car, they can reasonably expect that they drink too much of it. They're going to have a reaction that they ought to be responsible and avoid that if possible. But what I want to know is, and I think you've said it, but isn't there a situation where a person can take some kind of medication where they are not reasonably expecting this kind of reaction, but it could happen, and it may not happen every time, but it could happen sometimes. So there's certainly no intent there for this kind of thing to happen, and my concern is that this would cover that when maybe it shouldn't cover that.
So and the main point being, with alcohol, the anticipated effect is well known. Mm-hmm. Given whatever dosage is taken, there's some relative effect as opposed to the unanticipated effect of some medication.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. You said it far better than Richard or I.
President Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the other troubling thing about the A2 amendment is that the language of may impair the ability to drive. I mean, you're either impaired or you're not. And so that may really leaves it up to some officer's discretion somewhere about what's taking place. So that's one point I wanted to make. The second point is I was pretty sure when we left this, the only debate that we were having about whether to include the inhalants or not. So this is really a lot different than...
Well, this is creative amending.
This is truly creative amendment.
That's why we circulate these things ahead of time. But I haven't seen the other amendment either. So we'll await that and, of course, ask you to peruse that. And I'll ask council to get that expedited. And we do appreciate your coming in this morning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we still haven't seen a fiscal on the amendment as well.
That's right. All right, anyone else here? Yes, please come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lieutenant Hayes of the Oregon State Police, and I just have a couple of comments real quickly about this amendment. And even though it may seem very vague to some people, I just would like to mention that we've had documented incidents where people have used over-the-counter substances to an extreme degree. And I think it comes down to responsibility and the burden of proof of showing and proving that the person is intoxicated. A person that uses an over-the-counter substance the way it is supposed to be and responsible is not going to run into problems. And we're not encountering those people. In fact, it's very easy to determine a drowsy driver compared to an intoxicated or impaired driver. The incidents that we're running into, and I'll give you one example that just happened last month in the city of Medford. A 20-year-old male individual took 20 capsules of Sudafed, 20 at one time, and decided to drive and crashed his car.
Lieutenant Hayes, let me interrupt then. The question there would be whether or not we would want to have a specific provision for a person who intentionally takes an excessive dosage of a medication, knowing that that excessive dosage was likely to impair his capability to drive. Wouldn't that kind of phraseology cover that situation?
I would agree with that, Chair Mannix.
Let me write that down.
The cava, the 20 cups of coffee or something?
Person right. Intentionally
drinks too much coffee.
Consumes.
Well,
does, I'm just playing with
it. Question about that, though.
Sure.
But we're talking here about intentionally, but I keep going back to it. Some years ago, I was taking some antihistamine, and I had no problem with it whatsoever. And I ran out, so I took a different brand, and I crashed on the couch for the rest of the day. I mean, unfortunately, I wasn't driving, but I had no intention of ruining the rest of my day, and I certainly didn't have any intention of becoming woozy. I just took a different one, and it was over the counter, so I didn't expect there would be any kind of backlash to that. There certainly was, but we're going so far here to catch the people intentionally doing this stuff that we're endangering people who are not doing this stuff intentionally. I just want to delineate that somehow.
I'm playing with it a little bit. Listen to this. A person intentionally consumes a dosage which the person knows is in excess of the recommended dosage, knowing that the consumed dosage is likely to create, I won't say intoxication, is likely to impair the person's driving capability. It's pretty limited. But it would still cover the guy who just popped 20 Sudafed. I mean, I think most jurors would say, you idiot.
Would it cover the guy that drank 20 cups of coffee that he talked about?
The Kava Kava?
Yeah.
Maybe. Actually, I wonder how he wouldn't have to pull over to the curb every 5 minutes.
if I could clear that, Chair Mannix and Representative Bowman, the Kava Kava is not a coffee. It's a relaxant. It's an herbal relaxant. And so it really has nothing to do with coffee at all. It is something that people are now taking as a substitute maybe to some of the antidepressant drugs. It's a natural. And if it is taken again properly in the way that it is recommended, then most people are not having a problem. But in this particular case, that individual drank 20 cups of this and then elected to drive knowing that he was intoxicated.
Now, can we still get them for reckless driving?
Yes, sir. That's what it'd have to be refiled as, a reckless driving, and that's what we're doing now, or careless driving, or in some instances they're being dismissed.
What I'm picking up is some resistance to too broad an expansion here, but some willingness to include inhalants, because we now know that those inhalants not only are not prescribed, these aren't things that are prescribed for medical use, these are things such as kerosene and turpentine and whipped cream vapor from the compressed air, so that we're dealing with stupid conduct which could kill from other testimony, as opposed to getting into medications which occasionally can be abused. But we, you know, what I'm getting at, Lieutenant Hayes, is we may want to make sure we don't go beyond the necessary borders. But Representative Hansen.
Yeah, I need to maybe get clear on how the current system is working. If someone fails a field sobriety test, they're, you know, for obvious reasons, they can't walk or they're having trouble concentrating or whatever. What's the next step then if they're impaired, clearly impaired, but it's not because of either drugs or alcohol that can be proven through a blood test or a breath test.
Chair Mannix and Representative Hansen, normal procedure is if that person is deemed to be impaired at roadside through a series of field sobriety tests that the officer administers, then that person is arrested and charged with driving under the influence of intoxicants. And then a breath test is given, and if the breath test does not indicate to the same degree of impairment that was noted at roadside, then the officer would start looking for other symptoms of impairment. And many times they're going to call a drug recognition expert in who is going to do an evaluation on the person. And the DRE is going to be able to determine, is it medical impairment, is it medical and or drugs, or is it a combination of those, or is it just drug related? And then after the DRE and the officer does that evaluation and they still see signs of impairment, then they are going to go ahead and request a urine sample from that individual. Sometimes you can request blood, but for the most part it's urine. Then the urine is sent to the laboratory. And then depending upon that result is, if the urine comes back and substantiates what the officer saw as the impairment, then more than likely that case will be prosecuted.
Okay. So say someone could be prosecuted, maybe they consume some alcohol, but not enough alcohol to get up to the 0.8 level, but at the same time they've been mixing in maybe some legal prescription drugs that, again, in an approved dosage, that say if it was the combination of either over-the-counter drugs or prescription drugs that are used responsibly with an overlay of some alcohol, could that get you to the point that you could be prosecuted for impairment?
Chair Mannix and Representative Hansen, that's correct. You could still be prosecuted if the substance that comes back in the blood or urine is a controlled substance. If it's a non-controlled substance, then such as, and I'll just throw some out, Jimson weed or an inhalant or some of these newer types of depressants that are on the market that are non-controlled, if that's the only thing that is in that person's toxicology, then the chances of that being prosecuted are slim to none, and it will, because the prosecutors cannot prove a controlled substance is in this person's blood or urine in the body. And so therefore, it will not be filed as DUII. It will be dismissed.
Thank you, Lieutenant. I discern that we are likely to await amendments, and Lieutenant, I'd invite you to double-check with us about getting those amendments, because things are a little slow these days sometimes. I've been saying that all session about getting amendments back, and it looks to me like the most likely thing we'll do is look at the inhalants which are being improperly used that are not designed to be inhaled. We're not talking about medication that's inhaled, and at least we'll get that expansion. I think there's some support for that, so it's sort of one step at a time. And we would probably set a work session next week after we have those amendments available, and I want to give folks a chance to take a look at them, too.
Thank you, Chair.
Thanks for your time this morning. This concludes the work session on Senate Bill 443. I would like to announce that the Senate Bill 848, we have two sets of amendments here, but we've requested a third. I am discerning that the real support is to limit this bill at this stage to public safety officers and uniformed security personnel. That's the feedback I'm getting. So we'll order some amendments to do that and bring it back when we have that capability. Seeing no other business, well, I do want to mention that we are not meeting tomorrow, in case anybody thought we were. We are meeting Monday at 8:30. We are adjourned.